Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vashon.
And this is Michael Shook, your host of The Briefly Today. With me in the studio this morning is our usual gang. I won't add what we used to say and read in Mad Magazine. Anybody here read Mad Magazine?
Of course.
What are you referring to?
Oh, they used to have on their staff line there all the usual gang of idiots.
That's us.
Yeah, there you go. Well,
we can say that, but you can't.
Okay.
That's right.
Directly across from me, the flying cowboy, retired airline pilot, current small plane pilot, and our soundboard slinger, Truman Montana Tex O'Brien.
Montana Tex. This is getting worse every week, I'm telling you. I don't know what we're going to do.
I love it.
Sounds like a barbecue you need to throw.
Ratings are going slingle. Up, so I think you keep it going, Michael.
Yeah, ratings are going up. Yeah.
Have you ever lived anyplace else?
Yeah, I've lived all over the world.
Well, okay, so we can work that in.
No, I'm not going to tell you where.
Montana, D.C., Tex,
yeah,
Indiana.
I'm afraid to tell you.
Certain secrets are worth keeping.
That's right.
Oh, to the left of Truman, our resident empty space, Bruce Hallman is still down under, and his chair is still stuck in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, now trying to obtain passage to Venezuela. We move left again. Not to the swashbuckling sailor, and I wanted to put that in because you'll notice I said that this time. Swashbuckling. Oh, I blew it the second time. To Truman's left is the Dixie Darling, member of the string band Listen in the Kitchen, a poet, and agitator, Lynn Kerrigan.
Ooh, I like the agitator part. Well, agent provocateur is what I used to write on my tax returns.
Oh, my
That's
gosh.
That's before agent I went to philosopher saint. That gets less scrutiny.
I was terrified of putting anything like that on my tax returns.
I did it all the time. I figure I was a social worker. They knew who I was. Not anything unusual. I figure they expected it of me.
Wow.
You know, I had a reputation to maintain.
There you go. Maybe it's because I worked, quote, off the books occasionally, just occasionally.
Just occasionally.
That's all I'm saying.
It's a barter system.
There you go.
Yeah.
to Lynn's port side, left again for landlubbers, is the swashbuckling sailor and political seer, Indivisible Vachon's own Kevin Jones.
Aye, that'd be me.
Aye. Good morning.
Good morning.
It is Tuesday, February 18th, in the year of the tweeting twit. And with spring...
I almost missed it.
He's even more Twitter-pated, I think, now.
He is Twitter. Well, he's been emboldened.
New records are being set.
With spring and spring sports just around the corner, I think we would be remiss. Oh, wait.
Wait. I'm sorry. I have to throw something out.
Sure.
Wait, there's more.
We were speaking about number 45 there just a minute ago.
Oh, yes.
Yes. And I saw a meme this morning that I think is absolutely priceless. It's Groucho Marx speaking with a woman. And the woman said, "I believe Donald Trump was sent by God." And Groucho says, "What, was he out of locust?"
That's really great.
Actually, there are locusts landing somewhere now in Africa. I think it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sorry, holy cow.
They
no,
all
that's
have
great.
Orange hair.
I love that. I love that. That's like... I don't want to go there.
Back to spring.
Spring. See,
yes.
Spring sports, because spring is just around the corner, and I think we would be remiss if we did not note the passing of one of golf's great champions and two people deeply associated with baseball. All these things are spring related. So first off, golfing great Mickey Wright. I don't know if anybody's that familiar with Mickey Wright, but she died. She died at age 85. She was one of the, I'll read this a little bit about her. Mickey Wright won 82 tournaments in her career. That's third all time for anyone, male or female. Sam Snead, Tiger Woods, I think broke Snead's record and Mickey Wright, including 13 majors. She was voted AP Female Athlete of the Year for 1963 and 64, and she was really smart. She dropped out of Stanford in 1955 to start making her career as a professional golfer. And I thought this was interesting. No less a legend than Ben Hogan. So Ben Hogan, for those of you who don't know, is one of only six players in the history of golf among men to win the Big Four. Out of all the golfers, amateur and professional, to win the Big Four tournaments, he remarked that Wright had the best golf swing of anyone he had ever seen. Mm-hmm. High praise.
No
so
kidding.
Thank you, Mickey Wright, for all you did for women's sports and for the sport of golf.
And thank you, Michael, for naming a woman there.
Well, my dad was an avid golfer, and he followed good golfers, whether they were male or female.
That's great.
Yeah, she was something. Second, the writer Roger Kahn, age 92. Roger Kahn wrote many articles and 20 books, but is best known for his classic, The Boys of Summer, mm-hmm. about his days in 1952 and 1953 covering the Brooklyn Dodgers, Brian Brown's and my favorite team. Yes, the story is about baseball and the Dodgers of that time, but the book endures as a classic because it is, more than anything else, about life and all that goes with it. And I just wanted to read in the introduction here to it, just a brief thing here. Kahn wrote, "My years with the Dodgers were 1952 and 1953, two seasons in which they lost the World Series to the Yankees. You may glory in a team triumphant, but you fall in love with a team in defeat. Losing after great striving is the story of man who was born to sorrow, whose sweetest songs tell of saddest thought, and who, if he is a hero, does nothing in life as becomingly as leaving it. The team was awesomely good and yet defeated. Their skills lifted every man's spirit, and their defeat joined them with every man's existence. A national team with a country in thrall, irresistible, unable to beat the Yankees."
Wow. That's an incredible writer.
It's a wonderful book. Third, Japanese league legend catcher Katsura Nomura, 84, who later became a manager, as catchers often do. Nomura was second on the all-time list of home run hitters in Japan, second as well in total hits. And it's fitting to pay homage to an athlete of his stature, but his passing nearly coincides with a dark chapter in our history. Tomorrow marks 78 years since Franklin Delano Roosevelt issued Executive Order 9066, which authorized the removal and internment of more than 120,000 Japanese and Japanese Americans from the West Coast. 121 were from Vashon and Maury Islands. So that's why I wanted to bring up Mr. Nomura.
Including our now historical famous Matsuda Farm family was amongst them.
And I don't want to say a celebration, a remembrance. The day of remembrance officially is tomorrow. And this is a little past due here, but Saturday, and I'm sorry we didn't bring it up last week to folks, but there was a remembrance service. It's really something. And that brings me to words. Why do we accept euphemisms like internment when what was done was imprisonment? The same is true of detainment. We say we are detaining immigrants in Tacoma and many other places, but in fact, we are imprisoning them. Some have been there for over a year. In Guantanamo, Cuba, we have been detaining people for almost 20 years. How is this not imprisonment? In China, the government there has hundreds of thousands of Uyghurs, a Muslim ethnic subgroup of the Chinese nation there. They are detained so that they can be, quote, cleansed of the infection of religious beliefs, which the Chinese government also insists are a form of domestic terrorism. And Lynn, you brought up the other day that the prosecutors in the Roger Stone case were described in the paper as having withdrawn from the case.
Right, rather than resigning in protest.
Yes, in fact, they resigned in protest. With all the doublespeak? I don't know.
Well, come on. It's like the terrible events of 9/11. you know, the tragic events of 9/11. That's what people are saying. You know, mm-hmm. baloney, man. It was a terrorist attack. Come
yeah.
on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, let's call tell it what like it is.
Is there something... I guess there is. There's just something in us that wants to make it mushier or something.
I don't know.
Gosh, to me, it seems like we want to avoid the seriousness of what we're doing. Yeah. You know, we put it in prettier terms.
There's a whole science behind it. Read George Lakoff's book, Don't Think of an Elephant.
Ah.
The interesting thing is when you hear the title, Don't Think of an Elephant, most people think of an elephant.
When you said that, I immediately thought of an elephant.
Yeah. Elephant. And you know why? Because it's not something you're expecting, and it's sort of like, oh, what is he talking about? So, but it goes back to when Nixon said, I'm not a crook. What did you think? Oh, you immediately associate him with crooks. So it's very, you know, there is, so read, if you want to dig into it, if our dear listener wants to go there, George Lakoff has a fascinating book about messaging, and it's about claiming terms and repetition and assignment of language to certain events. And it gets to the point where certain language doesn't work for us anymore, actually. When certain words are denigrated, they lose their original meaning, and people then have to shift the language to another term because the terms are so full of weight that you can't move them.
Separated
they're no longer
from.
Agile.
Oh,
yeah.
Interesting. Very interesting.
Yes. Well, what it reminds me of is, and maybe somebody here will remember the author of A Nation of Sheep, which was one of the political standby books of my young growing up that talked about how we can use language to just call those sheep to the barn every night for their feed, as opposed to the things they might get into if they were not being led with such a harsh hand. And I think that, you know, we are in a time when it's easy to be led by kind of false promises and kind of false inflammatory, quote, facts, and harder to think about what to rise and respond to. You know, there's so much shock and awe.
There's a lot being thrown at us.
And yet, here we are, refusing to be sheep on the Brown Briefly and to call it like it is.
And many other places.
Many places.
It's fascinating to me to see the way that folks are responding in individual ways. And I read this about Somalia. I thought that was fascinating. I don't know if anyone saw that. But it's an example, kind of what you're saying, Lynn, that the Somalia's government has just been in horrible disarray for decades now, and the struggles of the people there with warlords coming in and terrorists coming in from another direction and the country being all fractured. And the younger generation there has said, okay, we're not going to wait around anymore. We're not going to be the sheep just kind of waiting for someone to herd us where they think we should go. We're going to jump in there and say, okay, what needs to be done? We're going to identify it and come up with some solutions to at least start to work on it. And it's proving to be effective. It's giving them traction. They are making headway in helping people after terrorist attacks, or helping people get educated, helping people get access to school so they have a shot at education.
Small, many local efforts. But I think that from the national level, the other point that I'm making is that we seem to be in a period where it's hard to tell who are the sheep and who are the wolves.
Who are the
You know, and I just think that we need to be alert all the time to the language around us that may be hurting us places we don't want to go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you said something quite a while ago, Lynn. You were talking about critical thinking.
Right.
And I've never had really paid much attention to that term before. But, you know, it's actually something that I think I've practiced for a long time. Mm-hmm. I always try and look at both sides of an issue, no matter what it is.
That's even a place to start.
No matter how controversial it is. And try and say, well, now, wait a minute. Why are they saying that? Why do those... I don't think that that's right, but why are they saying that? And so even today, I try and occasionally look at Fox News to kind of see what's going on, you know, because we tend to be here on the island, tend to be so far the other direction.
And in some points of fact, there is serious motives that are being withheld from people.
Oh, yeah.
So it really does benefit us to ask why. You know, who's benefiting from this? Well, qui bono?
The one thing that I try and do, and I find it really hard to do, though, is to say, now, wait a minute. Let me think like that person. Let me think, why is it, why do they believe that? Why do they think that's the way it is?
Mm-hmm.
And try and think like that. And it's kind of enlightening.
I think that can be a really enlightening exercise. Yeah. I worked with a couple of guys on my the crews that I worked with in construction. And they were far more conservative than I was. And over time, the conversations in the lunchroom and everything would shift around to different things. So as we got to know each other, we went deeper into taboo subjects like religion, sex, politics, which are the best fun ones to talk about. But the more I was able to listen, not uncritically, but the more I was able to listen and hold off on judging folks, that was key. That was really hard to do, and I still am learning that.
That suspension of judgment is what's so hard, because we remain kind of fixed around our judgments.
Sure,
we filter everything through our own judgments.
And I wanted to jump in there with, well, I'm right on this or whatever. But gradually, I began to understand more of their point of view. And while I still disagreed about certain things, I realized these are really heartfelt things. And they're well thought out according to their value system. And so that really made me start thinking differently about folks, not being so dismissive of someone.
And I'll go back to you again, Len. I'm pretty sure it's you that said that, you know, we have to listen to what somebody else is saying and say, okay, let's see what they're saying. What is it really about? And instead of waiting just for our turn to speak.
Exactly.
You know,
so. It's easy to do that. Shut off things that you don't want to be hearing and just wait for your turn. Much harder to honor somebody else with a full explanation of kind of why they're where they are.
Or to say that person's really stupid because they don't get it.
You know? Yeah, it's easy to go there. Yeah.
And they're an evil person. They just don't get it.
You know? Far too much of that in my youth. And that's my defense. I was young. A couple of marriages later and
you're older and wiser. Is that what you're saying to us here, Mike?
Well, I'm older.
The step that I think is really hard to take in critical thinking, and this seems to be where we're locked into positions now, is to get out of the polarizing dynamic. Because if you're stuck with two opposing sides thinking that's the only way to solve a problem is to beat somebody until they're bloody and down. It is not the way to solve problems civilly, where you're looking really for, so what are some other ideas that we could move on?
You don't solve the problem. I mean, if you win, well, you haven't won.
If you're beating somebody bloody to the ground.
Exactly. That other person still is going to have that.
That's right. One of the things that I always thought about when I was trying to influence activities, either at work or even outside of work, was, and this, you might think this is appropriate, you can't steer the ship unless you're a member of the crew.
There you go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the idea that unless you find some common ground to where you can see, understand each other a little bit and be part of a similar team, you know, you're really not going to have much of an impact on people's thinking. So, yeah, it's important to, I think, find that way to communicate. Mm-hmm. And the words, going back to the sort of theme we sprung from, you know, we do wrap things in words. And the Freedom Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
But for many, their values don't represent freedom for certain groups. But nonetheless, the Freedom Foundation is a very aspiring name. right? Mm-hmm. It sounds good.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So it's always...
Can't argue with that, with Freedom Foundation.
Exactly.
Yeah. Same with the American Heritage Foundation. You have to dig one level deeper to find out whose heritage they're exactly talking about.
Ah, mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, and so the notion of looking into these things and who, you know, who is behind the facade, who's behind the labels in front of them, and where do they come from, mm-hmm. is pretty important.
Good stuff.
Thoughtful.
There. Yeah, yeah, thoughtful. Yeah.
But one of the things that's intriguing is also how we're so malleable in the face of that. Somebody mentioned to me several months ago a film, The Brainwashing of My Dad.
I think I may have heard of that.
Yeah,
tell us
it's,
more.
I think it's intriguing, and it kind of relates to a little activity I did this weekend. Looking at Republican and Democrat Facebook pages.
Ah.
So the brainwashing...
Talk about words and polarization and...
Well, there's all that too, yeah. You know, so The Brainwashing of My Dad is a story about a woman's father who lost his job in the hometown and picked up a job in the next town over. But it was about a 45-minute commute each way. And, you know, driving in the car, needing something to keep yourself entertained, was talk radio. And a world of Rush Limbaugh and Fox News and et cetera in rural America is largely your choice. And the documentary goes on about how this woman's father just had a very substantial change in views, substantial changes in being less sort of positive about how things were going, became overly more and more angry about what was going on.
Boy.
And the whole evolution of his personality as he shifted and was listening to more and more talk radio.
Fascinating. This is interesting.
And not just talk radio. We're talk radio, but extremely conservative talk radio.
Conservative talk radio.
Shock jock talk
and
radio.
There's another word. There's another word, conservative. Some of my good friends are what many people would consider conservative, but they're not... it's not a pejorative term. I guess I would say that they are conservatives, and I feel this way too very much about certain things, that there are things worth conserving.
Mm-hmm.
There are,
surely.
There are things that, that make us a society that is fruitful and good to live in. And those things are worth conserving. And I think sometimes we get those terms, you know, to say someone's conservative now, and in some places, perhaps on the
so
blue coast.
So could I have said ultra-conservative, or what would have been a better
crazy
description?
No,
in that radio?
You know, I had a really interesting conversation with a group of friends.
I don't know what you... I don't know, Lynn, but that's a good question. What do we say?
Anyway. So, well, it reminds me of this conversation about a liberal... and progressive, or liberal versus progressive. Mm. And so we were talking about progressive values, mm-hmm. and pointing out that the opposite of progressive is regressive. It's not conservative. Mm-hmm. And somebody pointed out, well, the only reason you're using progressive is because the conservatives have poisoned the word liberal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you've chosen another word to substitute for the poisoned word. And you've chosen progressive, and it doesn't really mean the opposite of progressive is regressive, because you've replaced liberal with progressive, and the opposite of liberal is conservative. So what are you talking about?
And now we're overthinking everything. My brain is swirling.
I know.
Because, you know, my dad was a conservative, and under, you know, Ike and the earlier Republicans, it was not a pejorative. It meant that he took things slower when it came to change than a lot of other people did. Mm-hmm. He would say he was a fiscal conservative and a mm-hmm. kind of social progressive. And Truman is over here saying that's me. That defines a lot of people who don't want to rush into unproven programs or unproven spending of money. You know, there's a lot to be said for it. And to me, it's been a good balance with liberal values being from the humanity side. I'll take liberal as the core meaning of liberal, you know, the things that we fought revolutions for about the civil rights and the value of the individual above the state.
Talking about liberty, being able to, you know, have the freedom to make some choices about, you know.
Yes. And I thank you for saying that that word has been poisoned, because it has. And I'm a proud liberal and in all those ways. But I understand completely when somebody says, but I want to be conservative with my investments for Social Security.
Darn right.
Or conservative with some of the social changes. And there's that tension we've had. The sort of the back and forth tension with do we go forward with sweeping social change and that causes a big upheaval, or do we go slower with that? And sometimes, perhaps oftentimes, going slower with certain kinds of social change means people are wind up being denied their liberty. And especially, of course, as we all know, females and people of African American descent, people of different Asian nationalities, people who look different. But I do, you know, my dad was, he was a fiscal conservative, but he was also, and I've said this before, he loved to ask me that, this is great, son, you're going to blow this whole thing up. And change it all. Now, what are you going to put in its place? And that was, and I never, you know, of course, being a callow youth, would just say, oh, well, you know,
we'll figure it out.
We'll figure,
can I use this as a point of transition?
Because absolutely.
Paul Krugman had an article in today's editorial page for the Seattle Times that was titled Bernie Sanders is Not a Socialist. And I want you to know that's another word that we've been arguing about for a long time, because I've said 1,000 times Bernie may be making an error by calling himself a socialist when what he is promoting is social democracy, which is the distribution of wealth through social programs. That's not about nationalizing the means of production, the government deciding how to run the economy. Those two completely different things, to share some of the wealth. And this article by Paul Krugman is saying this is another example of words that I have the big potential to backfire in young people that are looking forward to see how the growth of the country could accommodate more of them and more social liberties for people who are very diverse in our country now. We're a very diverse country. You know, they have grabbed onto the socialist word, and so has people that support Kashama Sawant in Seattle. You know, in many ways, in my opinion, they're like the bell ringers for our democracy. And you know, if this is not given to the least of us, you know, do any of us deserve it? You know, I mean, those kinds of questions. But I do think that with this election, it's a question for me about political strategy of whether what we are calling, what Bernie Sanders is saying, socialist or social democracy. Because I personally, I fear for the consequences of him calling himself a socialist.
And socialism, as most people think of it, I think people think socialism, Soviet Union, and that experiment didn't work out so well.
Well, that was communism, actually. And that's what capitalists have done. They've conflated the two. They pulled them together.
They called themselves the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, which was
clever.
Very talk about wordplay there and disguising things. Yes.
But I do think, Lynn, that the label of Bernie Sanders, I don't think I'm not sure if I've heard him call himself a socialist as opposed to democratic socialist.
He does say democratic socialist.
Yeah, I think he does. But then what's happening in the language battle, right, this tug of war, is it's now the socialists, it's the crazy socialists, and now the crazy do-nothing democratic socialists, right? So we've all heard those words, and that's the paintbrush that's being splashed over the whole Democratic Party. And that's why it's being done. It's because the associations then become clear, and that's the repetition, right? Is to try to cement those associations between words and parties and people's concerns, right? That go back to a time that isn't now, but did shape people's views back in the time I was growing up, certainly.
Sure. And that's one of the reasons Margaret Thatcher, who had some real strengths, I've been reading some interesting articles about her political heritage, but she had some pointed things to say. And one of them I remember about socialism was because, of course, England is far more socialist than the United States has ever been with their health programs and everything and unions. And she remarked once that the problem with socialism was that eventually you run out of other people's money, which was a totally Reagan-esque quip and everything.
Yeah, and probably not really true.
But those words really played well with her constituency.
Mm-hmm. So,
and Truman was going to...
I was just thinking about FDR. You know, when he came along with the CCC and the WPA and all of those programs, those were... even way, way far more socialistic than anything we're doing today. Mm-hmm. That's for darn sure. But even Ike with the interstate highway system, there's those programs that here's Eisenhower, super mostly conservative guy. Yeah.
A moderate conservative.
That was a brilliant move, though, because I've been reading this. There's a woman, Swedish economist, who's talking a lot now about how one of the best moves of social democracy is to invest in infrastructure. And that is not sort of, like giving people free money. It's doing something that draws the entire nation together. Sure. It puts all kind of people to work, and it makes our country more accessible to more people. And so it was a very wonderful binding thing to do. Anyway, this Swedish economist is saying, why are we not doing that now? Yeah. You know, we could be repairing our dams and our bridges and
a southern wall.
Sorry.
We're doing that with the military money, right?
I just had to throw that off.
But I was just thinking, the Democrats could brand Infrastructure Week as a socialist movement.
Right?
Socialist movement. You're taking all of our money and spending it, on things that bring us together. I guess it wouldn't work.
I think the word, it just, that word, it's going to have to go the way of something.
Well, we're going to have to get more capable of saying that doesn't apply here, or that's noise, or that is not germane to this conversation, because, we tend to race after those things like they're squirrels and abandon, our own arguments, which is that it would be a great thing to put a lot of labor people to work, and it can go everywhere.
And it's not a social program, it's an investment in our future and our infrastructure.
Yes,
our productivity.
I was just gonna say, investment. There's, and that's what I'd love to see. That's what's been disappointing to me when I read the paper the day after one of the debates between the Democratic candidates, is there's so much of it is this picking away at each other. And I know that criticism is necessary of we need, critical thinking helps us make critical decisions, criticism in that sense. But to be tearing at each other and saying, well, your record in the past isn't as good as my record in the past. It's like, tell us what you're going to do to help pull the country together. How are you going to invest in the American people? And those are kinds of words I think that really resonate. Yeah. When I hear someone say the American people can da 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 da, it's like, even somebody who's as cynical as I've been in my life, feel a kind of a little, yeah, American people, I'm one of them.
Mm-hmm. Well, if China can build a hospital in 10 days.
Yeah. Did you see that?
Yes. I mean, look at the power of pulling, harnessing, you know, people together in some kind of a common, you know, endeavor.
Endeavor, yeah.
I mean, boy, that was an incredible achievement by them.
And I wonder how much of that was pulled together, how much of that was someone with a big stick there saying, we're going to get this thing built in 10 days, or it's all off to re-education camps or something. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah.
Well, there was a lot of wheeling and dealing when Lincoln pushed through the railroads as well. Yes, sure. Yes, there's going to be political arguing.
And that was more carrot, though, than stick, I think.
They're
handing out land and money as fast as they could.
I'm not
sure
the Chinese would say it was all carrots, the ones that came over to build the railroad, but I agree that, you know, I guess what I'm saying is there's just a lot of worry and concern and hesitation and confusion about what to call things, much less what to do, you know, and I'm with you. I'm ready to hear, you know, us come out of the weeds and get behind the big ideas that we have that most people can agree with. And that's why I kind of talked about this. Bernie isn't a socialist because, you know, we're toggling kind of between some bigger movements and ideas about go big or go home, go left or go home, versus some moderate positions, you know, Klobuchar and Buttigieg in the middle kind of saying, wait a minute, you know, are we really ready to go 180 degrees? Can we not save the Affordable Care Act and do some other things and get us better positioned to right the country, right the ship of state? So, I mean, I think these are very legitimate arguments, and I don't know how it's going to fall out.
It gets back to those words again. How do we use the words?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting. I'm thinking of Klobuchar and Buttigieg and how hard it is to get traction for some of those folks in a when they don't have the money that someone like Mike Bloomberg has.
Man.
And he's got what? He said he's just essentially going to just...
already spent $380 million.
Yeah, and he's got...
His own money.
When you've got that kind of dough, you can just start buying up stuff, which, I don't know, if he had a whole lot of really great ideas, but yeah, he's still forming up what he's going to do. But
yeah, when you're in the billions of net worth and the millions look pretty small, it's sort of like when Romney in the debate said, you want a bet, and he... was a $10,000 bet. Do you remember that one? That was a slip of the tongue that probably lost him a bunch of voters who are not taking home $10,000, maybe even in a year sometimes.
Yeah. Wow.
Kevin, can I ask you a question? I mean, I know Indivisible Vashon is kind of a big umbrella group and that you must hear these questions and arguments all the time. What is the position of Indivisible Vashon on developing platforms like that?
Well, that's a good question. Actually, we have a meeting tomorrow night at the library at 7 o'clock. Doors open at 6:30. Our position is that we provide information to help people make a decision, and that we talk about values and what values are important, and methods by which people can identify the candidate that is most closely aligned with their values. And this is during the primary. We don't take a position on that other than to foster a conversation about it. Now, that'll all change after the Democratic National Convention when we're asking everybody to align behind the nominee for the president because we think that there are so many things that this current administration is slowing down things that we care about. On the environment, on immigration, on healthcare, on, you know, treating families with respect. So we know we can do better. But yeah, in the primary, we really encourage people to be sort of thinking on their own.
Scary thought.
But I like something that stuck out there. What you said was that you guys talk about values. Mm-hmm. I think that's crucial, because that kind of informs how we make decisions. Well, what do we value?
Yeah, we also talk about, you know, our big objective is to get better leadership. And we know that we have to get over a hurdle that's in front of us, which is the 45th president. And so we recognize that it's important to that objective serves many of our values. And so that's one thing that's really clear in our minds. But other than that, we think it's important to look at who the Democratic presidential nominee will be, and to articulate how that person is more representative of our values than the current leadership. And that while people are, the challenge I think we face is better is the enemy of good enough, mm-hmm. if you will.
Exactly.
Right. And the notion that my vote somehow defines me, when
that's interesting.
The bigger reality might be that your vote might define a reality for somebody who's not as privileged as the voter is, right? And so it's important to recognize that it's not just, I don't view my vote is mine, but I view that I share the outcome with others. And I think it's important to understand the implications of that and what the consequences are of, say, being sort of, could I use the word selfish about how I want to use my vote?
Mm-hmm.
I think we should use our vote with empathy as well as looking at what is of highest value to us.
Here's how I've talked about that. Maybe this comes from being a woman and using a lot of retail therapy metaphors, but I used to tell people that I didn't see my vote as being like, I'm going to Nordstrom's to buy me a coat. I'm buying coats for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
With my vote.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I like that a lot.
Yeah.
So it's retail therapy for me, but it's also thinking about coats for everybody else. Uh-huh. That you cannot be such an individualist when you're voting that you refuse to go and vote if your candidate is not nominated. To me, that is infantile. And I can understand it, that people are frustrated, but I agree with you that anybody in our field of candidates would be a better leader than Donald Trump.
Well, one of the things I think, Michael, you said quite a while ago, when you're looking at these, at the candidates, you're always, and their platforms, you're always saying, what's in it for me?
Mm-hmm.
And I think what you're saying, Lynn, is what we really need to ask in is what's in it for us?
Yes.
You know, which is a little bit different, mm-hmm. a little bit broader.
And even the us, we should think about as not being just us in our bubble of people
that
we like,
exactly. All
but
of us.
Us as the commonweal. You know, mm-hmm. us as a nation dependent on our vote.
Yeah, I agree.
Try to remember the e pluribus unum. I mean, out of many, one. And this is interesting because all three of you have spoken here about, again, about values. But values, it seems to me, when I was listening to that, rooted in community, in the knowledge that it's not just me. I mean,
we're out
my
in
old
the weeds
man was,
here. I'll come back to golf. We're out in the weeds here, but we are shooting for the hole.
Got to get back on the fairway. Oh, we're out of time here. All right. Well, thank you, and adios.
Until we meet again.